Welcome to day two, session five of our Technology Matters panel discussion. This panel is about streaming video. One of the things that I thought about in reading all of your research is the sort of prominence of streaming video in our popular culture. So we have examples like the 2008 elections in which YouTube was used as part of the debate process. CNN now, and I know some of the other corporate media, are using user-generated, I wouldn't say reporting, but user-generated content and stuff that's put on YouTube for their broadcasts. We also have the developments in Egypt where live streaming audio is now possible, and so reporting from the ground is making use of the real-time experience of the event, and that sort of changed the coverage. We also famously had streaming video of the Gulf spill at the bottom of the ocean, and that really affected the coverage and people's sort of imagination of the scale of the problem and how fast that disaster was developing. We also have common phrases like videos going viral, and of course we've watched in this class some TED Talks and other videos that were streamed over the internet and used in different contexts. So in considering all of these sort of developments and the impact of streaming media, what do you all consider the most unacknowledged or interesting aspect of its increasing prominence?
I think the most interesting aspect would probably be how far the tech has come in general. Like Terry was saying, you know, we have live streaming video of political campaigns, of the Gulf oil spill, of the unrest in the Middle East. I think it's come a long ways, and it has definitely changed society as a whole in terms of like the coverage. People react differently to it, and a lot of things can't be edited out in this live video. So its effect on society has been really big, and I don't think a lot of people realize how big it is until, you know, you really consider the deeper issues that have been involved.
And one of the things that you covered in your paper, you talked a little bit about cyberbullying and its connection to the fact that we can stream, videos of other, people, you mean people that we don't know.
Yeah. Well, definitely on YouTube. I mean, even if you search for cyberbullying on YouTube, you'll find videos of people getting bullied all the time, like, just random fights of where some kid is on the bus and all of a sudden he gets sucker punched by the guy next to him. It's kind of sad that, people just go out there and they videotape this purposely to put it on there and humiliate others for it. And there are other aspects of cyberbullying, too, that don't involve YouTube, but I think having the video there is, it's always on 24/7, and anybody can access these videos. Like, they post on their Facebook, and then everybody on the Facebook page can go and view this. And this kid, can't get rid of it, kind of like the Star Wars kid. He tried to take that down, and it pops back up, because, you can't really get rid of something that popular, and even though that kid doesn't want it on there, it's still there, regardless of whether he wants it or not.
And I don't know if this connects with directly with your work, Brittany, but you had talked about the use of streaming video and streaming media in political process. So we have this sort of negative cultural effects of producing this material and putting it out there. We also use it for changing our institutions and so on.
Correct? Yeah, it can definitely be a positive thing. In the case of cyberbullying, it's obviously really negative. But when you look at the statistics of the YouTube website, as of May last year, more than 24 hours of video are uploaded every minute. It's the third most visited site on the internet with 2 billion views each day. So the scope of YouTube is absolutely enormous. And for the 2008 presidential debates, they had a program called YouChoose where candidates were able to upload their own, or the voters were able to upload videos of them asking questions to the candidates, and the candidates had to respond to them candidly as they were streamed live. So obviously it had a really big increase on the participation from voters, and a study found that traditionally politically underrepresented or inactive voters were participating in these types of things, so it broadened the scope of those interacting in the elections, and those who participated were actually more likely to vote in the elections overall. So it was really interesting to see how just a little change in the way that voters can interact with politics has a dramatic effect on whether they vote or not.
And when you were doing this research, was there anything about obviously it made a case for the increase in participation, but was there any commentary about the sort of quality of the video, not the video quality, but the quality of the ideas and how they were exchanged at all? Or
in the same study, there was a quote that the submissions, while they were from a politically underrepresented population, they were also politically substantive, they were actually relevant to the elections, and of the 8,000 videos that were submitted, the vast majority actually were relevant. So that's also really exciting that even though there are voters who normally wouldn't have participated, they obviously, from things like YouTube and other social networking, they're getting a different perspective of the political landscape, and they're able to participate in a more intelligent way.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting, to see how, if it again gets used in 2012, and see how, if there's been techniques and because there's been more, I guess in a macro sense, cultural practice in producing these things and more exposure, I wonder how, if there'll be more strategic or more subversive or more helpful. Maybe this speaks to what you wrote about, Tiffany, with community and streaming video. You have a connecting comment there?
Well, it just shows that through commenting and sharing videos, like embedding links, you can share it to anybody in the world, your family, your friends, and it kind of generates discussions, and like you can relate to others through the videos, or you can maybe have a debate over the content in the videos, and that can change the way your family relates to each other, like their relationships, and you can change your friendships with others. And there's one video, it's like the greatest freakout. Actually, there's a lot of them. But one of the little brother videotapes his older brother whenever he has freakouts. And in one of his interviews, the interviewer asks the guy who freaks out a lot if he knows like what he thinks about the videos. And he doesn't even know that his brother is even posting those videos. And and then his parents always have to assure them that they deleted them, they removed them, they're all off the internet. But actually, they're still there, and his brother just doesn't know that he's being showed online. And like even when he goes to school, he doesn't know what people think about him. Maybe. So.
You know, and it makes me think of a recent video that I watched. There's now this explosion of videos of how-to videos of how to use particular technologies, and it's sort of like supplementary marketing for some of these devices because they're kind of showing you how to use them, and also, you know, adding to their sort of cool factor and culture because, you know, you have people using them and using them in different ways, and it's sort of broadcast on YouTube. But there was competition between these two YouTube broadcasters on the use of this technology. And through the comment function, which is something that you talked about a lot, a community sort of developed, and they ended up being really good friends, whereas originally their two broadcasts were seen as rival sort of how-to broadcasts on YouTube. But the comment function and this and the ability to rate each other's and seeing the connection between these videos, I think, actually created an interesting micro community, I guess.
I think why streaming media has become so popular lately is because we talked about how in Brittany's essay, she talks about how YouTube is so easy and accessible, especially for like political games, etc. And in my article, in my paper, I talked about how like there's three fundamental characteristics of streaming technology: is that it's simple, flexible, and interactive. And of course, like on YouTube, it's so easy just to browse your videos on your computer and then push upload, and there it is, right? And so in education, they found it that professors and teachers were easier to adapt to this technology just because the interface with the technology is just so simple. Just, you know, write what you want people to see and then push publish. And so, I think it's just very relatable to how streaming media has become so popular lately, just because of its simplicity.
Yeah, I'm wondering how to connect these comments we've been making about mostly YouTube or user-generated streaming media and technology to other types of streaming technology, like Hulu or sort of more illegal things. Like now there's capability of streaming live TV. So we talked in another panel about virtual private networks and our ability through software to create these sort of closed networks within the internet, and then allowing people access to that, and then using tools to broadcast to them stuff that they're pulling off of their TiVo or live, you know, live events. So if you don't have TV but you have the internet, which I know there's some people out there that are like that, you know, you can watch the Super Bowl on the web through this sort of streaming technology. I was curious if you guys had any thoughts about the other end of the streaming video technology, the less organized around production but more about transmission.
I guess I can kind of connect the two.
Sure.
I think, as from my research with politics, it's kind of a transition from the passive to the active involvement. So as with user-generated videos, they are actively contributing to the YouTube space. But in the same sense, when someone goes to Hulu to watch their favorite television show, they're actively choosing which episode they want to watch.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to in the past, if something's on TV, you just kind of sit back and, oh, this is on, this is given to me, and this I don't really have a choice whether if this is a channel I would like to watch, then I'm getting whatever show is on there, and that's that. But with Hulu and other opportunities to go back and replay that favorite play from the Super Bowl or rewatch my favorite episode, it's more active and dynamic that you can kind of pick and choose which kind of media and streaming video you want to consume instead of just having to sit back and accept what the media is giving you.
Right, and so that's also a layer of the interactive component of this technology that I think we should supplement that other sort of content generation interaction with in terms of selection and being able to make decisions about what you view, not just what you create. I don't know if this connects somewhat indirectly to your work on collaboration and amateur culture.
Oh, yes, because in my paper I mentioned the video streaming is pretty much like social network, like vlogging. It seems like people just like click on video and then sit back and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are just those underlying, I mean, the functions on the surface as a collaboration that's like underlying, like we don't really realize that that's forming a collaboration, but I think it's a different kind of collaboration. It's not like Facebook, you create an invite and bring everyone in there.
Mm-hmm.
This one is like people just meet and try to like figure out what they want to do.
Yeah, this makes me think of sort of another indirect connection, but one of the things that really fascinated about what you wrote, Bo, was that as we collaborate more and more in these digital environments, which are creating all these new ways of interacting and sharing, that there's also this sort of unspoken component of energy use that's changed, right? So maybe you want to talk about that. I thought it was an amazing point, because streaming video is energy intensive.
Well, like, as the technology has become more popular, like, it's become more like of a resource and asset to teachers and, well, to everyone. Like, everyone uses it for whatever leisure or for educational purposes. And I don't know, in my paper I kind of argued that if, you know, these two are going parallel with each other and become more intertwined with, like, especially teaching, like, for example, in, you know, college, there's a lot of, like, web interfacing. Like, you have to go to Catalyst Tools to, you know, look for a video that they post on class. Or even, like, our readings, we don't even have to read anymore. We have to watch a video for class. And so it's, the drawback is that it's still technology that relies on energy. And I guess it's...
And not human energy, right?
No,
it's like electricity.
It's electrical energy. And, you know, lately, you know, it's like, how are we going to produce energy if, you know, if we don't get it nuclearly, or like if we get it wind, or...
Sure.
So I think, in a way, we need to find a better way to make it more efficient, that it's not, that it's more separate from, being bound by energy constraints, whereas so that way, in case like a big major failure happens, class doesn't get canceled. Because we know that if, for example, if UW's main system closes, I don't know, we probably won't have school the next day because teachers can't access, you know, gradebook files, etc. So, you know, in the past century, they could still do classes without a lot of technology.
Right? Right. You would come to class with some paper and pencil and a book
and
right?
a candle, right? So.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That's a long time ago, but
still.
I mean, we have behind us this white screen. I'm projecting. We're projecting behind us from a computer a white screen, and I remember hearing, I think this has got to be over 3 or 4 years ago, someone had developed a front page for Google that was black instead of white because, and I can't remember the calculation, but it would save a ridiculous amount of energy just by changing the color of the web page because of the amount of energy required to display the bright white background that Google sort of uses. And so it was an interesting sort of historical moment because it connects to this really important point that I think you're making, is that all these technologies, these electronic technologies, are really energy intensive, and particularly streaming video, because it's constantly processing, not only with processing power, but the display, right? The screen technologies is sort of connected to screen technologies, I guess. This is a really interesting point. Well, we're a little bit short on time, but I wanted to ask the second question because I think all of you, through your research, had an interesting kind of ambiguities about the benefits and the sort of drawbacks of this technology. But sort of trying to think back how you approached streaming video, and now having done some research, have your views about this technology changed, and would you approach it differently in the future?
I think this technology shows like the boundary between the hub media and the co media is gone. It's like if it's a hub media, like we can, now it's a digital era, we can like add an interface to make it code media to any type of like, hub media.
I definitely, after reading everybody's papers, I didn't realize how big it was or the issues involved. And It definitely makes me think about, like, you know, what goes into posting a YouTube video, the energy use, who's in it, how they're affected, and I thought it was really interesting. I think I'll definitely, every time I click on a streaming video, I'll definitely look at it differently from that because of these papers.
Yeah, that's a good list that you just produced, and one of the ones that I think was most surprising to me was the idea of thinking about who is in the video that you're producing. Unless it's just yourself, I mean, that's an easy sort of, situation to think about. But when we're, like, let's say instead of doing this podcast, we did a video cast, your personages would be digitized and put on a web page and publicly accessible, and it seems like a very different thing to archive than our voices. Other thoughts about the future?
Yeah, before this paper, like, whenever I watched videos, I never thought about the extent of the impact that the videos could have on the person that's in the video and like who watches it. Because now a lot of videos have parodies, like the Charlie Bit Me movie video. It's like there's one that's like 5 years later. So now that changes how Charlie and Harry are going to be perceived in the future. You never know. We don't know what's going to happen to them in the future because they're not old enough yet. So they've kind of lost their identities because we're in, the users are in control of their identity now.
I think another thing how you're saying that we underestimate the impact that these kinds of technologies can have. One of the examples that I found most interesting from my research is the 2008 release of Will.i.am's music video, Yes We Can, which kind of came alongside the presidential elections, obviously. And within the first month, there were 5.4 million views of this video. And within the first couple of days, the Obama campaign team actually posted a couple of links to it on their website and on their social networking site. So while Will.i.am created the video probably as a way to push the Obama campaign forward, he probably had no idea that it was going to turn into something that the Obama team themselves adopted. And so it's kind of interesting to see how it was a huge benefit to them, even though it wasn't something they generated themselves.
Yeah, so the public creation of even non-political videos can become have some political efficacy when they're put into these systems. Okay, I think we're done. Thank you.